Welcome to The Out Agenda, coming to you on archive.kpfk.org. I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh. This week on the show, we're going to have actor, writer, director Tony Spinoza, and he's going to talk about his new musical, Singing Revolution, the musical. And Rita, this is, it's a telling of an event that happened in 1987. And it's so interesting how pertinent this is to what's going on in the world today. It's a really interesting story. Can't wait to hear about it from Tony.
Before we introduce Tony, we're going to play a teaser, some music from his show, Singing Revolution.
Tony Spinoza, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Tony, let's get right into the play. That's what we're here to promote. And Singing Revolution, the musical. Now, it's based on a peaceful protest in 1987 in Tallinn, Estonia.
Correct.
People sang in order to protest Russian interference.
Correct.
Which, you know, boy, that's something that's very pertinent to right now.
Oh. So this is based on a true story, or is something you just the setting?
It is based on historical events. The characters that we've created are fictional, but they are based on real life people who led the revolution.
Tell us a little bit about the revolution and why you found it so fascinating. It is fascinating, but
it is. It's a story that I believe most Americans are not aware of. And I stumbled across this story back in 2014 when I was on a cruise in the Baltics. And there was some unrest in St. Petersburg at the time where we were scheduled to stop. And they decided to stop us in Tallinn, Estonia instead. And at that time, I had very little knowledge of Estonia. I did not know the country, the culture, or very much about them at all. And during my travel there, they took us through Old Town, which is very quaint, very Disney-like architecture. And then they took us to their song festival grounds. And know that singing is a very big part of Estonian culture. They actually teach children to sight read music in the first grade, whether they can carry a tune or not. They're very big on music. And the tour guide started to talk about these events that happened between 1987 and 1991, called the Singing Revolution, where the people would come together in mass events, I mean, huge events. At one point, 2 million people gathered to form a Baltic chain, a human chain. It was 400 miles long. And they were singing for their freedom against the Soviet occupation, the illegal Soviet occupation of their country. What's so fascinating to me about this story is there are several iconic events that create the Singing Revolution, and they received their independence from the Soviets without one drop of bloodshed. Now, that's it's amazing to hear that people actually used singing as a shield against the Soviets, and they actually succeeded. So that was the basic inspiration.
You know what? I wonder if we could get our president to watch this, because maybe it'll give him some good ideas.
Right.
Ukraine, you know. So what exactly, you know, what happened? I know you kind of briefly explained it, but what music did they sing? And you wrote original music for the play.
Correct. Yeah. At the time, you know, it was the late 80s. So they did sing some traditional Estonian songs to protest, but they also sang pop music, current pop music. Writers from Estonia would bring in new songs that were contemporary of the time. So it was a mix of songs in there. And I chose to use a Europop score for this show because I really wanted to pique the interest of the youth of America. I'm seeing a decline in interest in American musical theater, and I think it's an art form that really is valuable to our culture and can use a little bit of inspiration. Mm. You know, things like Come From Away and Hamilton and Dear Evan Hansen, they're starting to bring back the younger audience, and that's what I'm trying to gear this toward.
Is it kind of, I think in Hamilton, it's kind of a like of a rap type, I guess, songs. And how they, is this what this is? Or you're just using songs that they sang these songs, were they considered illegal?
Some of them were considered illegal at the time. However, it was at the time when Gorbachev gave the country glasnost and perestroika, the freedom of speech. And that's when they took that opportunity to start singing about their re-independence from the Soviet Union. The songs in my show are all original songs. None of them are from the singing revolution. And there is a little bit of rap in there, but I wouldn't say there's a lot of rap like there is in Hamilton. But to keep it contemporary, yes, there is some rap sections in our show.
You said Europop. How do you describe Europop?
It's got Eurovision inspired me. You know, Eurovision's gotten very popular in the past couple of years, especially in America. It started to cross over. Music like ABBA inspires me into that genre. It's a little bit electronic, which is a different art form for musical theater.
Are the songs in English or in Estonia?
No, they are in English. There is one song that is the anthem to the show, Never Forget Who You Are, which I do have one verse sung in Estonian to give the audience a flavor of what the Estonian language is. It's a very unique language to their culture. It's a blend of several of the languages from Finland and Germany and Poland. It's a blend of all those languages. So I wanted to give a flavor of it in the show, and that's what we have.
Let's talk a little bit about the research that you did on this, because you did quite a bit of research. So you went over to Estonia and met with people over there. How was that? That must have been incredibly challenging.
Well, it was wonderful because I tell people that this story found me, because once I learned about it, I was I dove into it and it really started to encompass all of my waking hours to find out about all of the events of the singing revolution. And through the New York Estonian consulate, the government in Estonia got wind of me creating this musical, and President Tumas Hendrik Ilves invited me over as his guest and arranged for me to interview the people who are still alive. I mean, this was in 1987 to 91, within our lifetimes. And a lot of these people are my age. And I was able to sit down with them with a translator and talk to them about how they created these huge events like the Baltic chain, that chain of 2 million people, which was done pre-internet. You know, they had to go to choirs and to church clubs and to book clubs and pass the word along to fill this chain of protests. Another event that happened was an attack on their government castle. It's a Tumpia castle is their government castle. And when the Soviets were trying to take down the leader of the independence movement, the leader of the Estonian movement got on the radio and said, Tumpia castle is under attack, Tumpia castle is under attack. And the people of Tallinn flooded the streets of Tallinn and surrounded the castle and began to sing until the Soviets retreated. There's video footage of this in a documentary by James and Maureen Tusty called Singing Revolution, the documentary. And it's riveting because it looks like it's a powder keg waiting to happen. But you see these people peacefully protest, and then like the parting of the Red Seas, they make an alley for the Soviets to retreat. Now, when James and I started writing this book back in 2017, we had no idea that some of these events were going to be so resonant today with what we've experienced in the past year and a half, between the Black Lives Matter movement and even what happened on January 6th. The events that are in this musical are very resonant, and it's history repeating itself is what we're presenting on stage.
Let's talk a little bit about the characters. How did you decide on who the characters are going to be? How did you develop those?
Yeah, it's interesting. My first draft of the musical came out like a history lesson. It was very much a teaching story. And that's when I brought James Bearhard in to help me co-write the book. We turned it into a character-driven piece, which is inherent to American musicals. And we use the device of star-crossed lovers to tell the story, to propel the story forward. So you're seeing the leader of the Estonian independence movement fall in love with a Soviet commander's daughter. And you see the struggle about what goes on between those two cultures.
It's like Romeo and Juliet, sort of.
It is sort of.
Or the Sharks and the Jets.
Right, exactly.
Now, are this history, is it being taught in schools? Because obviously it's after I went to school history. Do we know about this?
I have to say that in all of the Americans that I've spoken to about this subject, they know nothing about Estonia or this revolution. I think that at the time, we were so concentrated on what was going on in America, the Gulf War specifically at the time, that we weren't looking at what was going on outside of our borders. And I happen to be someone, I travel a lot. I love in experiencing different cultures. And I actually watch BBC News over American news because I like to be informed of what's happening around the world. So I'm not sure if it's an American thing or if this piece of history just never made it into our school systems or you know, into our teaching history.
Tony, I'm kind of curious about the entire process of writing music. Okay, so you get this idea in your head that, you know, you're feeling very passionate about this project. Yeah. So what happens next? Does music just pop into your mind? How does it play out?
Yeah, well, my career has given me a very strong understanding of the structure of the American musical. And this is structured as a typical American musical, very much like a King and I or a Fiddler on the Roof or a West Side Story. The structure of this show is true to an American musical. And there are different types of songs that help to propel your story. For example, one of your first songs in the show needs to be your hero's I Want song. What does he want from the piece? What are you in store for? That's one of the pieces. There's always your act one climax finale. There's also always your 11 o'clock number for one of your leads toward the end of the show. So these pieces I started to put together, and then I would start to hear what this music would sound like, how it would elevate the emotion of what these characters are feeling. And the songs started to come to me pretty organically. Some of them music first, some of them lyrics first, and then James and I would fine tune them to fit the story.
How do you write the music? Are you a musician also?
I am a musician. However, most of writing this musical was singing things into tape and then getting people to give me a chord structure for it and then soup it up in the studio with demo recordings. So it wasn't, I didn't take a pen to paper. A lot of it was done electronically through voice memos.
Yeah. That's very impressive.
Now where is it playing? It's playing now, I believe.
Correct. We actually opened, we had a short pause because of Omicron, and we are officially opening this Saturday night, January 29th at the Broadwater Theater in Hollywood. That's on the corner of Santa Monica Boulevard and Lillian Way in Hollywood. And we'll be running through February 20th.
And is this a two-act play or is it a one-act?
It is a two-act play. It runs 2 hours, 20 minutes.
Oh, it sounds like a lot of fun.
It's
educational, but wow. Now we want to talk a little bit about you. Who is Tony?
Sure.
Ralph has all these questions for you.
Great. Bring them on.
Well, you know, I was just kind of curious as an out composer, an actor, director, writer. I could go on because you have quite a few hats that you interchange between. Well, what's that like? You know, what's it like, you know, you think, okay, it's musical theater, which, okay, God, there's, you know, I mean, you know, how could you possibly have any issues being gay in musical theater? But that's not always the case. Did you run into any roadblocks along the way?
Well, you know, in the early years of my career, of course, you know, back in the 80s, we were hesitant to come out and confess that we were gay and be out with our sexuality. That got a lot of easier as time progressed and people were more accepting of the gay culture. I can't say that it has hurt my career or damaged my career in any way. I've been very fortunate. And I've worked with some wonderful gay directors who have become my mentors, not because they're gay, because they're really good at what they do. And they've taught me how to be a good director.
Don't you find that... And it sounds like we're a very similar age, living through the 80s and experiencing the AIDS epidemic and everything that was going on, that, you know, we're in a place now where our sexuality doesn't really play a part in almost anything that we do, and how where before there was such a focus on that. I'm an out actor, and you know, that's what everybody wanted to pay attention to, where now things have just really kind of quieted down, and you're just a director, singer, songwriter, you know. Do you feel that way working in theater now, where it's just not an issue? People just don't care.
I do. I feel that there are other groups that need the attention now, and deservedly so. Groups that have not been able to have not been handed the opportunities to move further up in the ladder, especially in the, I'll speak specifically in the entertainment industry. And I think that these groups deserve the attention and deserve the time to join us as we rise up and continue this this art form.
Now, do you make an effort as the creator to be more inclusive in your cast or in your writing?
In casting, absolutely. In the writing, because I was writing about historical events, it was hard to be diversified in the writing. I had to concentrate on the story I was telling. However, when I put on the director cap and I started to direct this play, this musical, we went for complete diversity so that everyone is represented in our cast. And I think it adds a wonderful flavor and a universality to the production.
I just want to know, does Mikhail Gorbachev sing?
Yes, he does. And he sings rap.
You know, normally we ask about the director first, about themselves before we go into the play. We sort of did this a little backwards, but but I wanted people to know who you are.
Thank you.
And it's nice to know that, because, you know, it's great to go see a play, but the person who actually came up with this too, the creative person, I think is very important, because what we see is hopefully is what you envisioned when it's all done, because Ralph's an actor and he knows that too, that, you know, you want to get it right is what
sure.
It is. And we want to know the person who did it.
Yeah. What's interesting for me was during my career, I've done adaptations, I've done jukebox musicals, and I was really looking for an original story to tell, you know, much like Come From Away is an original story about Gander. And I think this original story is very much going to put Estonia on the map, because it is a humanitarian story. It's about social justice. You know, it's a big theme of our show is that an act of kindness can change the world. And I think those kind of messages are really important today and uplifting to people. And I think we need that today.
And our students today need to know about, or the youth need to know about all this that happened, not just the highlighted parts of here and there, because these people, what they risked their lives.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of them fled during the Soviet occupation. And I've spoken to a lot of the Estonians who live in America now, and they tell me about their travels and fleeing Estonia during the Russian invasions and how they got out of Estonia without the Russians detecting them. Fascinating stories, but they're strong. They have a lot of perseverance, and I really respect them for it.
When you go and research a story like this, are you kind of really, and it sounds like you are, amazed by the experiences that people have, that in our country, we have such, protected lives, I guess. You know, we go about our business, and you look what people go through around the world and the trials and tribulations that they have to experience that we don't know anything about here.
Yeah. And that's why the story that I tell, it's a 40-year time span, because I had to set up in the beginning of the play where these people were coming from. I mean, they were so repressed by the Soviets that they couldn't show their Estonian flag, any of their Estonian heritage, or they'd be taken off to Siberia. They couldn't even celebrate Christmas. They would have their Christmas tree tucked in a closet. They would close their window shades and they'd open up the closet for a couple of minutes so they could enjoy Christmas. This is how repressed they were as a society. And to see where they've come to through the revolution and now where Estonia is today, being one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world. I mean, they created Skype in Estonia. They because they were so poor when they received their independence, they turned to technology, and now the entire country is full of technology. They vote online, renew driver's license online, their medical records are online. It goes on and on. It's fascinating how they become a world leader in technology.
Do they still sing though?
Absolutely. Just before the pandemic in 2019, I was the second time guest of the president of Estonia, and he took me to their, it's called their Laulupidu, which is a song festival that happens every 5 years, where they have a, at the song festival grounds, which looks a little bit like the Hollywood Bowl, but a little bit bigger. The dome itself holds 37,000 singers with one conductor, and they sing as one voice. It was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever witnessed, because being guest of the president, I was right down in the front row with hundreds of thousands of people behind me, with 37,000 singers and one conductor in front of me conducting these voices that sounded angelic, a sound that I had never heard before.
Are any of these people able to see the play?
Some of the Estonian consuls from around the country are flying in to see it. I know the consul from San Francisco is coming in to see it. They're trying to get someone from Washington, D.C. to come to see it. And as we gain more momentum with the project, I'm sure that we'll have more of the government of Estonia coming over to see it.
Will they be able to do any virtual or taping of the play for people who can't come see it?
Yeah, we're talking about that because we are an Actors Equity production. There are some restrictions on how much we can film, but I am definitely discussing that option with our general manager to see how much life we can have online with the show.
Wow.
Are you going to Broadway with this?
I hope so. That's the goal. Yeah, there's no sure way to Broadway, but there's various routes, and I'm trying to explore every one of them.
Before we go into doing the last the contact information, I just wanted to ask you what it feels like to, because what I'm sitting here and just so incredibly amazed by is you hear about this incident in some obscure place in the world, and I don't know how many, you know, months or years later, you're sitting with the president of that country watching a concert in the country. I mean, that's that's amazing. What was that like to have gone from, you know, uninformed about the situation to sitting with the president?
What's wonderful about this project and what really keeps me going is that since the inception, since I learned about the story, this project has taken on wings of its own without me even having to feed the fire very much. Once the Estonian consulate in New York heard about it and told the president of Estonia, and then the invitations started to come in, the project started to grow and take on a life of its own. I just feel very fortunate to be the one that's able to tell the story of Estonia's history. I feel honored.
Were you in awe, or did you kind of expect some of that, or?
It was a little bit surreal at times because, when I was over in Estonia, I was on the Estonian news pretty regularly because the whole country had heard about this Italian-American writing this musical about Estonian history that they're very proud of. And I'm very proud of them for what they achieved. And I think it's the quintessential example of the power of peaceful resistance. And I think that's the big message that I really want to get across to people, that violence is not always the answer. We can achieve great things by peaceful resistance.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said.
Thank you.
Rita?
Well, I was going to say, once again, let's give them that information about the play.
Great. Well, we are playing at the Broadwater Theater in Hollywood from January 29th through February 20th. You can get tickets at www.singingrevolutionthemusical.com. And we look forward to seeing you there. It's a wonderfully entertaining evening. The two previews we had prior to shutting down for a couple of weeks, the audiences were on their feet at the end. And I look forward to that reaction as we reopen on Saturday.
And it's not just singing, it's dancing also.
So that is correct.
A lot of energy in the play.
Oh, yeah, we forgot about the dancers. Well, thank you so much for joining us here at The Out Agenda. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Here. Come see the show, please. I think you'll be really entertained and inspired.
I really do want
absolutely.
To see this.
Yeah. Wonderful. God, Tony, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ralph. Thank you, Rita. It's been a pleasure.
Once again, that was actor, writer, director Tony Spinoza, and he was talking about his new play, Singing Revolution, the musical. A proof of vaccination is required for admission, just so that people know when they go, and that mask must be worn throughout the performance. So, just going to put that in there. And with that, And we want to hear from you. So tell us what you think of The Out Agenda and about the kinds of stories and interviews you'd like to hear.
Like us on our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, or email us at theoutagenda@gmail.com. I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh. Thanks for listening and have a wonderful week.
And remember that being out is the first step to being equal. Now stay tuned for This Way Out, but we're going to have a little music from the Singing Revolution.
Kind of shows you when they ask me what my biggest challenge is and I answer it honestly, then they respond by showing that it is my biggest challenge by trying to silence me.
Let's be honest, the gays love First Lady Melania Trump.
When LGBTQ conservatives align themselves with the Republican Party, it can be an enigma, and it raises an important question. Why would people who are LGBTQ themselves and straight allies align themselves with a political party that opposes equality for LGBTQ people?
Thank you. to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Chile's new progressive cabinet boasts two queer members, gay teen battles bias with TikTok takedown, and queer youth question queer conservatism. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 22nd, 2022. Chilean President-elect Gabriel Boric has named two openly queer people to his strikingly progressive cabinet, another reminder that elections have consequences. Lesbian Alexandra Bernado will serve as sports minister in Chile's majority women cabinet. Gay Marco Antonio Avila will be education minister. Movimiento de Integración y Liberación Homosexual, MOVIL, is the country's major LGBTQ advocacy group. Spokesperson Javiera Zuniga celebrated the diversity in a statement that read in part, "Sexual orientation and gender identity are irrelevant for the positions. Capability is the only thing that matters." 14 of Boric's new 24-member cabinet ministers are women. Like Boric, several are former student protest leaders. The president-elect said in announcing his choices on January 21st, "We have formed this team with people who are prepared, with knowledge, with experience, and committed to the agenda of changes that the country needs." The young president-elect will turn 36 before he and his cabinet begin work in the South American nation on March 11th. That's the day after lesbian and gay couples can begin tying the knot under recently enacted marriage equality legislation.
Marriage equality was unanimously rejected by the Constitutional Chamber of the Supreme Court of Justice of Honduras on January 17th. The ruling came in two related cases. The plaintiffs say they will now take their cases to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the judicial arm of the Organization of American States. Honduras is bound by that court's 2017 ruling for non-marriage equality countries in the region to open the civil institution to gay and lesbian couples. Of the 20 member nations of the Organization of American States, 12 still deny them that right. However, those governments can flaunt the Inter-American Court's decision because it carries no enforcement powers. Meanwhile, Mexico is essentially piecemeal marriage equality. Its Supreme Court ordered a state-by-state process that still leaves six of its 31 states standing at the altar.
It's official. Taiwanese gay husbands Wang Chen Wei and Chen Chun Ju are the island's first queer family to adopt a child together. The formal adoption papers were signed on January 13th. Under current laws, married queer couples can only adopt their respective biological children. Wang postponed his wedding to Chen in order to adopt the child as a single parent without complications. Late last year, a family court in the city of Kaohsiung gave Chen the green light to adopt Wang's adopted child. Signing the papers this week completed the process. Activists' enthusiasm for the action was tempered by the fact that it sets no precedent. Although Taiwan is the first jurisdiction in Asia to open civil marriage to same-gender couples, it declined to include equality in adoptions. A bill to remedy that omission has languished in the legislative yuan for more than a year. After their historic adoption became official, Wang told reporters that he and Chen are not a charity case. We shouldn't have had to fight for it.
Another thing Taiwan's marriage equality legislation did not include was recognition of binational couples. Japan's international news service, NHK, reports that 42-year-old Ariyoshi Ishiburo and his 34-year-old Taiwanese partner, Lei Oyi-jen, have filed a lawsuit in the city of Taipei. The couple is demanding that civil authorities accept their marriage registration. Their lawyer says it's the first time a Japanese citizen has been involved in such a legal action abroad.
At least seven U.S. states rang in the new year banging a new batch of bills to limit the rights of transgender and non-binary young people. NBC News counted at least nine measures in Alabama, Arizona, Indiana, Kentucky, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and South Dakota. They aim to prevent trans and NB youth from participating in school sports, from using campus bathrooms that correspond to their gender identity, and from receiving gender-affirming health care. More than 280 anti-queer bills were introduced in 33 state legislatures in 2021, according to the National LGBTQ Human Rights Campaign. At least 130 of them specifically targeted transgender people. Bills to ban trans student athletes from competing under their gender identity passed in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Mississippi, Montana, Tennessee, Texas, and West Virginia. The sponsors of these measures are almost exclusively Republican. They claim they want to protect a level playing field for cisgender girls and women in school sports, and to prevent young trans people from making medical decisions they might later regret. They also cite potential disruption in gender-segregated public facilities. Speaking to NBC News, longtime trans advocate and media manager for the National Women's Law Center, Gillian Brandstetter, called it a hostile and dangerous trend that I'm sure we'll see continue through the year.
The vice presidential pet made famous by two children's books has died. Marlon Bundo was owned by the daughter of former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, Charlotte Pence Bond. She made Marlon famous as BOTUS, Bunny of the United States, in her children's picture book about the black and white rabbit, illustrated by Karen Mother Pence. Hot on Marlon's heels hopped a parody published by late-night comedy host John Oliver that outsold the original. A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo lampooned Pence's well-known opposition to marriage equality. Marlon falls for another boy rabbit, only to be blocked from marrying him by the stink bug, an official with a less-than-subtle resemblance to Vice President Pence. The parody publication was dedicated to every bunny who has ever felt different, and all proceeds were donated to the teen queer youth suicide prevention group, The Trevor Project, and to AIDS United. Now a reporter for the Daily Wire, Charlotte Pence Bond said at the time that she bought Oliver's book to support those charities, as well as the charities her book supported. She tweeted the news of the rabbit's passing on January 15th, writing, "Marlon, God brought you to us right when we needed you most." Many queer kids can say the same.
Finally, the U.S. Department of Education is investigating the largest Mormon university in the world for bias against LGBTQ people. Complaints that Salt Lake City, Utah-based Brigham Young University is violating the civil rights of queer students sparked the probe into whether enforcement of its honor code of conduct unfairly targets them. Conduct totally acceptable among hetero students can even lead to an LGBTQ person being expelled. The federal investigation began late last year, according to the Salt Lake Tribune. The revelation comes on the heels of reports that BYU had banned all protest actions around the iconic Y on the mountain overlooking the school. Last March, activists lit it in rainbow colors, and BYU could not have that happen again.
It's just kind of like one step forward, two steps back.
BYU junior Christian Hunt told local TV station KSTU that he's cautiously optimistic that pressure from the feds will lead to significant changes.
I've grown up in Utah, and I understand kind of the invincibility that the Mormon church can have. And so I kind of was like, wow, this is so cool. But somehow BYU escapes it every time.
Senior Everett Patterson told the TV station,
"Queer students are held to a different standard than straight students because a straight student wouldn't be expelled for going on a date or holding hands or kissing."
That's News Wrap. Global queer news with attitude for the week ending January 22nd, 2022. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can read the transcript and listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio channel on YouTube. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Melanie Keller. Stay safe.
This Way Out is supported in part by contributions from our listeners.
Some give a little each month. Some make a larger annual contribution.
More information and a link to give are online at thiswayout.org.
Some LGBTQ conservatives have said, perhaps jokingly, that it is more difficult to admit being conservative than it is to come out as LGBTQ. So what is the issue?
queer youth examine the issue. But first, a gay teen TikToks matters into his own hands.
He was like, oh, well, like, that's not what, like, I expected you to say. And I was like, you expect me to just be okay with the fact that you're literally censoring me and being like, I'm not putting this in here because you're gay.
Some liberals say that it's okay for people to be queer as long as they don't flaunt it. But it seems to me, my dear, that we've seen straight folks flaunt their sexuality for years. Sounds a lot like blatant homophobia to me.
A high school senior's viral TikTok video shows that homophobia is alive and insidiously well in the U.S. 17-year-old Tyler Johnson enrolled in Tully Junior Senior High after moving to Syracuse, New York from West Virginia in 2019. He told local media,
"The students there are great. They're super, super accepting. I just came out right before I moved to Tully."
So all was going well until the encounter with Principal Mike O'Brien that Tyler revealed on TikTok.
"So my high school has this thing that they do. It's like a monthly like newspaper issue that they put out. But in all of them, they do like a senior spotlight. So they pick two seniors each month to do the thing. And I got chosen to do it. So I was like, this is great. Like, so cool, right? So I answer all their questions. They email me like a list of questions. And one of the questions was, what challenges have you faced and how have you overcome them? So, you know, I answered truthfully with the biggest challenge that I had to overcome. So I said, the biggest challenge I faced was growing up gay and coming out. I had to learn how to become comfortable in my own skin and how to stay strong through bullying and all the negative experiences I had while trying to navigate through life. You know, I'm answering honestly. So then today my principal like stopped me in the hallway and is like, I need to talk to you. And I was like, okay. So I didn't think of anything about it. So I go into his office and he's like, so essentially what he said, I'm going to shorten it down because I got like 2 minutes left. He was like, pretty much we can't put this in. We're not putting it in. You have the option to either completely get rid of the question or rewrite it. I said, better idea. Completely take me out of the senior spotlight and I just won't do it, you know? He was like, oh, well, like, that's not what, like, I expected you to say. And I was like, you expect me to just be okay with the fact that you're literally censoring me and being like, I'm not putting this in here because you're gay. So then my mom calls the school and, like, talks to him.
Even in another question in his spotlight, he said Tully was his home.
Pamela Custer supported her son to reporters.
Like, he was safe here. And so for them to ask him to take that out, they took his safety net away from him.
Just kind of shows you when they ask me what my biggest challenge is and I answer it honestly, then they respond by showing that it is my biggest challenge by trying to silence me.
Tyler continued his story on TikTok.
So I call the school, talk to him, and I'm like, so I know you talked to my mom, but I just want to let you know that I'm standing with my first decision and I don't want to be featured in this or whatever. And he was like, but you're such a unique student, like walks our halls and like you're such a positive face in our community. And I was like, yeah, but here's the thing. There are so many kids in our community and in our school that are going through the same things that I've gone through and that I'm still going through. And them reading that from me and like seeing that in like our school newspaper would give them the courage and like, you know, give them the strength to know that like it's okay to be yourself. But now they're not going to have that. And that's your fault. So yeah, we'll see how this unfolds because I'm not done with this.
Tyler told the press,
I love the families and I love the students. And I really don't want people to think that all the parents and students and families have this mindset in this community because they do not.
In fact, queer supportive teachers, parents, and students showed up in force for an emergency school board meeting to consider Tyler's situation. Among them was a local elementary school social worker, Kyle Taranto.
I was immediately appalled when I saw it.
That's because of the way Taranto's welcome bio was received by Tully School's Superintendent Robert Hughes about a year ago.
He had pulled me aside in the hallway and said that I would have to take out the fact that I have a husband in my bio. So I was very upset about that. I was told that it wouldn't be able to be printed because board members wouldn't approve of my sexuality.
The principal at Taranto's school supported him, persuading Hughes to eventually relent and print his bio as written.
I was naive and thought that, you know, it was going to go away and it was fixed. But apparently we still have the problem. And my biggest fear when it happened to me was that it was going to happen to a child.
Tyler's side won at the school board meeting. Superintendent Hughes issues a statement saying in part, Clearly, as a school district, we have to do a better job of supporting our LGBTQIA+ students. I have room to grow in this area as well. He only spoke briefly to reporters after the meeting.
I'm glad they're supporting Tyler. I really am.
But class is dismissed for Social Worker Toronto.
I am currently still employed. I've submitted resignation as of Saturday. So my last day with the district will be February 25th.
Tyler Johnson's moment in the senior spotlight teaches us all something.
You feel like we've come so far as like a society, but then something like this happens and then you realize we're not as far as we think we are.
Sounds a lot like blatant homophobia to me. It happens left and right. That's why we must unite. We gotta stand and fight that old homophobia.
Signed up for our e-newsletter Inside This Way Out?
We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming and deepening the conversation about your favorite international LGBTQ radio show.
To receive the occasional Inside This Way Out and let us know you're listening, email us at info@thiswayout.org.
You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
She made history as the first Republican First Lady to ever support our community, the Log Cabin Republicans, and LGBT Americans. Let's be honest, the gays love First Lady Melania Trump.
She's smart, she's fashionable, she's stylish.
Now don't get me wrong, we love President Trump too, but man, she made him look good.
Thank you, Mrs. Trump, for your support, for your class, your grace, your elegance, and your style, and for being the most memorable First Lady we've ever had.
The fawning foppery of the Log Cabin Republicans' fanfare for their fete with the former First Lady last November may or may not tickle your political funny bone, but the outcasting overtime crew is thinking more seriously about queer conservatism in the U.S.
This is Outcasting Overtime from Media for the Public Good, creator of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Hi, I'm Tim, an Outcasting Youth participant. The LGBTQ community, however you define it, is enormously diverse, filled with widely differing opinions on just about everything. Within the community, and a lot of people don't even like calling it a community, some people fight with each other over aspects of LGBTQ identity. Men fight with women. Some gay people say that being bisexual isn't gay enough. And some transgender people who have undergone medical transition say that other trans people who haven't aren't trans enough. There is disagreement on political and legal strategy that results from differing levels of discrimination. Gay people are often less oppressed by society than trans people, and as a result, to take one example, New York State enacted a non-discrimination law protecting gay people many years before the passage of a law that protects trans people. This caused huge tensions between gay and trans New Yorkers and those who support them. But a widely shared experience within the community is that LGBTQ people are often marginalized and oppressed. LGBTQ identity and equality are highly politicized by conservatives. There wouldn't need to be a fight for LGBTQ equality if LGBTQ people were in fact equal. It was a huge achievement to win marriage equality, but it wasn't anything like the last piece of the puzzle. There are many other critical areas where equality isn't a reality yet. So for many LGBTQ people, their experience of being marginalized and oppressed gives them solidarity with other oppressed minorities, and this often means that they are aligned with political liberalism. When LGBTQ conservatives align themselves with the Republican Party, it can be an enigma, and it raises an important question. Why would people who are LGBTQ themselves and straight allies align themselves with a political party that opposes equality for LGBTQ people? Without looking more deeply, it is true that being LGBTQ doesn't prevent anyone from holding conservative political positions. So there's no inherent contradiction, for example, between being transgender and favoring a free market unregulated economy and the death penalty, between being bisexual and opposing a woman's right to choose or government involvement in healthcare, or between being non-binary or gay and opposing regulation of guns. And yet, some LGBTQ conservatives have said, perhaps jokingly, that it is more difficult to admit being conservative than it is to come out as LGBTQ. So what is the issue? Why do some LGBTQ people consider LGBTQ conservatives to be hypocrites? Without getting into the complicated relationship between true equality for minorities and the modern Republican Party, it is safe to say that many Republicans, particularly those who identify themselves as social or Christian conservatives, oppose equality for LGBTQ people. Some LGBTQ conservatives don't think that the Republican Party is anti-LGBTQ. In an age marked by a meteoric rise in misinformation because of the internet and social media, some people blame fake news and simply deny that there's any opposition to LGBTQ equality by the Republican Party. And it is true that Republican citizens are not uniformly anti-equality. A 2021 Gallup poll indicated that 55% of Republicans support marriage equality, not as high as the 83% support among Democrats, but still a majority. But many Republican elected officials and other leaders take a harder line. Conservatives often oppose hate crime laws, even though LGBTQ people are at greatly increased risk of becoming victims of hate crimes. Republican state leaders advanced a record-breaking number of anti-LGBTQ laws in 2021. The Republican Party's national platform in 2016, which was readopted in 2020, condemned marriage equality. The Equality Act, which would finally add LGBTQ people to our nation's civil rights laws, is supported by congressional Democrats and President Joe Biden, but hasn't yet been passed in the face of substantial Republican opposition. And at the Supreme Court, conservative justices appointed by Republican presidents have talked about overturning marriage equality and allowing claims of religious freedom to override LGBTQ equality, something we're talking about in our current Outcasting series, which is available on our website, outcastingmedia.org. In light of this substantial division between conservatives and liberals, what might cause some LGBTQ people to support conservatives? One reason might be that LGBTQ conservatives want to reform the Republican Party from within and make it more inclusive and supportive of LGBTQ equality. Perhaps they feel they can be more effective at changing the organization by remaining inside than they could be as outsiders, possibly by keeping internal lines of communication more open. Another reason could be that many LGBTQ conservatives are gay white men, often the least marginalized group among LGBTQ people. Everyone has their own hierarchy of views. For some people, their social and economic position may insulate them from some of the day-to-day discrimination that less privileged LGBTQ people face. So if you're a business executive who happens to be gay, being able to run your business without government interference might be more important to you than discrimination faced by LGBTQ people. But it is not hard to imagine that the more oppressed you are, personally, the harder it is to ignore the oppression in order to support other political views. And this reality brings an important distinction into focus. When people vote, they understand that they probably disagree with their chosen candidate on some issues, but they can't pick those positions apart and vote for them separately. They have to prioritize what's important to them and choose a single candidate. So if our hypothetical business executive favors an unregulated environment for his company, he may vote Republican because he stands to gain more through the freedom of his business than he stands to lose because of discrimination. But is that a choice that shows any solidarity with the larger LGBTQ community? The story of Rob Portman, a prominent Republican senator from Ohio, offers an important lesson in empathy. Like most other elected officials, both Republican and Democratic, Portman wasn't an early supporter of marriage equality. What turned him around was finding out that his own son is gay. It is certainly a wonderful thing that Portman evolved. We hope that his relationship with his gay son is warm and loving, and we're very glad to have him as a rare Republican supporter on this issue. But shouldn't it be a given for elected officials to be able to empathize with struggles for equality without needing personal experiences to make the struggles real to them? Isn't empathy a basic human quality? shouldn't people be able to understand things that are beyond their own personal experience? Which brings us back to LGBTQ conservatives. Maybe they do care about LGBTQ equality, but not enough to cause them to vote against Republican candidates who oppose equality. So their shortage of empathy undermines equality for all of us. If the personal experiences of LGBTQ conservatives is that marginalization and oppression don't make their own lives miserable, can they at least empathize with the struggles of other LGBTQ people for whom inequality is a more pressing issue? Perhaps much more pressing? Equality is supposed to be one of the core values of this country. It is the foundation on which everything else stands, but it is not the reality for lots of people. And when LGBTQ conservatives vote for anti-LGBTQ Republicans, they are putting their personal interests and ideologies ahead of the larger struggle for equality of a community they belong to. If they betray this community by putting the basic human right of equality in the back seat, can they really expect greater acceptance among LGBTQ people? Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime from Outcasting Media, creator of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Outcasting Media is a production of media for the public good, based in New York. This piece was created by the Outcasting team, including Lil, Isha, Sasha, Justin, Sarah, and me, Tim. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and related content. You can also find Outcasting on Radio Public, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and other podcast sites. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and Melanie Keller, produced by Brian DeShazer, and from Outcaster Tim, produced by Mark Sofis. Romanofsky and Phillips, Sam Cooke, and Annie DeFranco performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, a bequest from Christopher David Trentum, and donors David Hunt and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 3UGE Alexandra Victoria, WJFF Jeffersonville, New York, KPCA Petaluma, California, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.